When a loved one dies, those left behind suffer for that loss. But when that loved one chose to take his or her own life, how do friends and family recover? In 2009, deaths from suicide surpassed those in motor vehicle accidents. There were more than 30,000 that year. In a society that lives much of its life online through social media, what happens to one's digital self after suicide? What is the life after death of somebody's profile? Is social media a good way for us to cope with the loss of our loved ones? I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and on today's Central Standard, we explore the prevalence of suicide in our communities, address the warning signs, and explore the online profiles of the deceased and what they say about them and us. That's ahead on Central Standard after this news. On August 15th, a Kansas City sports blogger who was obsessed with statistics published his final post. "The time has come to draw this quasi-hobby to an end," he wrote. "The reason for my departure is 100% within my ability to control. You see, earlier today, I committed suicide." Martin Manley was a former sports writer for the Kansas City Star. He shot himself earlier this month in the parking lot of a police station in Overland Park, and he left an extensive suicide note on his blog, as well as an intricate record of his life and work. This is Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Since Manley loved statistics, CNN pointed out that about 150 other Americans would take their own lives the same day as Manley. On our show today, we discuss the causes of suicide and how to prevent them, plus the afterlife of suicide, what happens to grieving friends and family left behind, and what about our digital legacy, blogs, Facebook pages, photos? Joining us in studio today is Marcia Epstein, director of the Headquarters Counseling Center, which runs a suicide prevention hotline. Thanks for being here, Marcia.
Thank you for having us.
Also here is Bonnie Swade, founder of Suicide Awareness Survivor Support, a regional organization for family members of people who take their lives to suicide. Thanks for joining us, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Bonnie, what was your reaction when you heard this story about Martin Manley here in Kansas City?
Well, I read the blog, and I was kind of devastated that he had spent so much time creating this when he could have used the time to help himself feel better.
How about you, Marcia?
Well, whenever I learn about somebody dying by suicide, one part of that is the sadness that this person's life was literally unlivable, whatever had been going on, and most often we don't know all of that. The other part was his death happened in a public place, which made it newsworthy. And he left an extensive set of information and easily accessed information on this website. And what I know is that when people are already vulnerable with already having thoughts of suicide, maybe even previous attempts and plans, they can be spurred closer to suicide because of information like that and how they identify with that person's choice. And so I had that concern about the number of people that might be negatively affected. And that part is a concern. And the projects that I work with are both the suicide prevention hotline for the state of Kansas and also a suicide prevention project for the state of Kansas to build a safety net. And our motto is awareness plus tools equal change. And that's what we need to do. And that's why I appreciate the opportunity today for Bonnie and me to be here, is that we get to talk about what can you do to make it less likely for this to happen to you or somebody you care about.
And I'll point out that the number, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, is 1-800-273-8255. And we'll mention that number a couple of times during this broadcast if you want to talk, right? I mean, what happens when you call that number?
Be happy. Do you want me to talk about that right now?
Yeah, just let me know.
It's an amazing resource because it's free and it's 24 hours a day. And anybody who works at one of the centers that answers the calls has been carefully trained to meet standards that no mental health person in the country is required to meet other than those of us who are at centers on the Lifeline Network. It'll be directed to a center based on your area code, which means for a lot of us, you know, my area code phone is a Kansas phone. So if I dialed it, I would reach the center that's in Kansas. So it's not shipped off to somebody else. It's somebody who has a good idea of things that might be going on for you, your culture of your state, your area, and has a lot of information about where to get help. But overall, what we want you to know is that it's private, it's free, it's easy to use, and it can be a help for any person who's affected by suicide in any way.
And you mentioned in this Manly case, you were worried that the way he did it and the way he elaborately explained it online would glorify suicide in a
way. Right. Because like Bonnie said, he spent a lot of time writing that information that could have been used to try to be helpful to himself, to those who would be affected by his death, you know, that could have perhaps been prevented, and also to prevent other people from making the choice that he made. You know, so there was a lot of lost opportunity there for so, so many people.
Well, I should mention, until recently, NORS organizations really, as a rule, didn't cover suicide. And that has changed in previous years. There's the concern of the copycats when it's newsworthy, a public figure, and in a public place, as you pointed out, the news organizations do. What are your thoughts about whether it should be talked about or not? Bonnie?
Well, I think that suicide does need to be talked about. I think we've spent too many years not talking about it. But I think we need to talk about it in the right way. And that is that we need to offer people hope, and we need to give them, as Marcia said, some tools of where they can get that help. And people should not be afraid to ask somebody if they are thinking about suicide. Too many years have passed where it's been kept in the closet, and it needs to be out there now.
As we say, talking about suicide, that's the first step in preventing a suicide. And having some media attention, even obituaries that mention suicide, help other people, because they know they're not the only family that happened to, because that can be part of what makes healing so complicated. But also, in terms of the media, there are actually some great recommendations for the media. And the basic piece of that is going to say, we don't want to glamorize. We don't want to make it easy for people to identify. We don't want to emphasize methods. And we always want to give information about what are warning signs, what a person can do to help, and where to get that help.
And particularly when someone prominent like Manly takes their own lives, you always wonder why. I mean, when anyone does. Marcia, what are the causes of suicide?
Well, and Bonnie and I can both speak to this from our personal and professional experiences. The bottom line is, when an adult dies by suicide, there's not one cause. You know, for anything that's part of why a person might have died by suicide, there are so many people who don't choose that. And in fact, just to give kind of a bigger perspective, the federal government, SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, does a study of mental health and drug abuse among adults. And their last one says 8 million American adults thought about suicide in the past year. Mm. That's a lot of people. Over 38,000 Americans died by suicide. Or the official count is over 38,000 Americans died by suicide in 2010, the most recent year we have stats for. There's a big difference between 8 million and 38,000. And so what we know is that lots and lots of things can be part of what brings a person to suicide, and there are lots of points where you can have some help. Some people aren't going to show any warning signs. They're just not going to let anybody know. But it's also believed that most people do. And the kinds of things, I lump them into a couple of categories. If you know somebody's gone through a lot of significant losses, so some kind of losses, it can be loss of a job. It can be loss of self-esteem because of something that happened. It can be the end of a relationship. It can be a death of somebody. Losses, and then another part is long-lasting painful feelings. And another part of that is really negative thinking, you know, it's all my fault, you know, and this stuff is never going to end and I just can't deal with it. And another thing that some of us might notice is people change kind of outwardly. Maybe they just stop kind of caring about their appearance. Maybe they were a good coworker or a student and now they can't really produce the things that they need to do for those activities. Maybe they're having a lot of physical complaints and that's not kind of how they were. You know, so there are those four realms that I think about with warning signs, you know, losses, painful feelings, negative thinking, and then these changes in the way we act and looked. And if you look at those and you also say, well, what are the most serious signs? Well, if somebody's talking or even hinting about suicide, and if somebody has attempted suicide before, and if somebody has lost somebody close to them by suicide. So those are one ways of looking at all that. And another kind of overview is to say, if somebody really has a sense that they just don't fit in anywhere, they don't belong, and if they have a sense of shame and like they're a burden to somebody, and if they have this kind of desensitization to violence, which can happen in a lot of different ways. It could happen from, I've attempted suicide, I've rehearsed suicide. It can happen because I'm a surgical nurse and I see people's bodies cut open. It can happen because I've lived in a high crime area. It can happen because I've been a soldier in a war zone. So there are lots of different things, and we can't exactly predict. But basically what we're saying is, if somebody seems like they're having a hard time, reach out.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Our guests today are Marcia Epstein of the Headquarters Counseling Center and Bonnie Swade of Suicide Awareness Survivor Support. We're talking about the factors that lead people to suicide. Do you have a loved one who attempted or succeeded in taking their lives? How have you overcome this loss? Or do you wonder what you can do to help someone contemplating suicide or grieving from it? Call us if you want to share your story or ask a question. The number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Marcia Epstein, is it always a case of depression or some kind of mental illness when somebody goes so far as to attempt to take their own life?
Research would say not always, but most of the time there could be a diagnosable mental illness. But a diagnosable mental illness doesn't mean that someone is in general so impaired that it's obvious to other people. And I also want to just say briefly, I know a lot of families who've lost kids to suicide. And with kids, what we know is that a suicide can be very impulsive. And so we also try to talk a lot about that issue of what kind of dangerous things do we have in our homes? You know, are there things that are just part of our family culture? We're hunters, and so we have a lot of guns and ammunition. But are there things like that in the home at a time when we have a child who's really going through a lot of things? Then we say, you know, it'd be really helpful to get all the guns and ammunition out of the home. It'd be important to get all the unneeded medications out of the home. So there are things that are different about kids than adults in terms of, for some of the kids that we learn about after the fact, it really seems like this event is what caused the suicide death. I crashed my car and I'm worried about what my parents are going to think and if they can afford to fix it, and a child ends up dead.
So it can be a more minor trigger, or what we would consider minor perhaps.
For a youth than it would be for an adult, because with an adult we know it's often years and years and years and years. And again, many times those layers of causes aren't things that other people know about with adults.
Bonnie Swade, have there been some recent trends in what is causing suicides or just even in the overall numbers?
Well, recently in Kansas City, there's been two suicides of young people that have just graduated high school. And I don't know if that is a trend, but I know that it is a concern that it's kind of, they don't know if they've made the right decision to go to college, to join the service. And so it's, again, like Marcia said, it could be a situational thing with a young teen that they're just kind of caught. One of the boys that I'm talking about had enlisted and then had realized that maybe that wasn't what he wanted to do. And so he didn't know perhaps how to get out of that. Mm-hmm. So again, it's could be a situational thing.
Do you hear about it when many cases are happening in this area? Like, how do you find out?
Well, I got a call from someone that wanted us to come and talk to the kids that had graduated and just wanted a perspective, somebody that had a support group, and to just talk to the kids, because unfortunately, many of the kids said, well, that's just so-and-so. That's just the way he was. And that isn't the message that we want to leave with those kids. He was having emotional problems. It's not okay to take your life.
Now, you mentioned that he had enlisted in the service, and you know, there's been a lot of attention recently to military suicides. And is that happening more here in the Kansas City area? Or Marsha, what do you hear about that?
Well, what we know is complicated in that overall, you know, if you talk about a certain age of men, almost all of them are veterans, you know. And so there's an issue about when you combine all populations of veterans together and try to make meaning of what's happening with suicide. There's the complication that now is being promoted more openly, that actually a lot of the deaths of military folks are people pre-deployment. So it raises questions about what's the culture of people who choose to be part of the military. But bigger than all of that is that, you know, people who work a lot in suicide prevention, and sort of one of the big advocates is a man named David Litz, who was in charge of the Air Force's suicide prevention plan and now works for the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, another national suicide prevention entity. And one of the things that's really important is to not consider it cause and effect, to not say because a person has military experience, he or she is going to die by suicide. There are lots of amazing stories of people who've gone through very intense, multiple deployments, and they are passionate advocates to help people do what they need to get safely through the thoughts and feelings and changes that happen with those experiences. So everything really needs to look at, I think, really needs to be looked at individually. We don't want somebody to say, well, because in my community, a woman with postpartum depression died by suicide, then everybody who has postpartum might die by suicide. We don't have to do that. We can get help instead.
And I understand there was the study that maybe you're referring to released by the Journal of the American Medical Association this month that showed that the number of deployments and number of combat experience actually doesn't increase the likelihood of committing suicide, which is what one might guess.
Right.
But the suicide rate of military personnel and veterans is still increasing.
But in some, when you break it down age-wise, in some they'll show there's no difference between veterans and non-veterans. What we know is that more men than women die by suicide. And we know that in many recent years in our country, it's really middle-aged white men who have the highest rates of deaths by suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's not just a military issue.
Bonnie, what about in the Kansas City area? What are the trends that you saw? Are there particular demographics that are more prone?
I don't know that there are more trends. I know that there's concern with the teens, high schools, kids. And like Marsha mentioned, middle-aged men are a concern. Things change in their lives and jobs sometimes go away and a spouse may pass away and they may feel like they're a burden on their family, but I don't know of other trends in the area.
And Bonnie, I know what led you to starting the Suicide Awareness Survivor Support was your personal experience with your son, and he served in the military, is that right?
Yes, he was in the military for 6 years, but he had had issues before he had gone into the military. So I have not ever thought that was maybe one of, it could have been a conglomeration of many things, but I don't think it was the sole factor of why he made that decision.
And why did you decide to start this organization?
Well, because I wanted to help others understand about suicide, and there is such a stigma that's attached to suicide. People are afraid to talk about it, and they think that it only happens in dysfunctional families, and it can happen in any family. And so I wanted to bring it out in the public and make it aware that it's okay to talk about it.
We have a caller here, Pam in Overland Park, who has a question about cases about the aging and people who choose to commit to die by suicide when they're older. Pam, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to, first of all, I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of your conversation. And a person who works with the elderly but also is aging themselves. And also, I've seen people and I've known people who either tried committing suicide or who actually accomplished it. Okay, so I don't want to get into that aspect of it. I think when you're dealing with younger people, it's a very different conversation. One thing that concerns me greatly is being a person who's aging is that I don't have the right to do it when I think it's appropriate. And I'm saying that because it's not because I don't find life valuable, et cetera, okay? But I think that I have the right to terminate my life as opposed to living as a ward of the state, which I've seen many people do, okay? I mean, I've had hundreds of cases of working with the elderly. I think people have the right. Most people want to languish and live out their lives. And there's some of us who don't. And I'm concerned because I think we always get this component of our community which wants to constantly do interventions and who wants to bring reason to a situation and value to a life which a person who's living the life has decided it's okay to exit.
Well, Pam, I think you bring up a really interesting point. I'd like to have our guests address that. Marcia, is that something that your organization looks at? Is there a question when people are aging and not well physically? Does that change?
Well, I think of a lot of things, so my answer is maybe not going to be as to the point, Pam, as what you had hoped. But I have worked in suicide prevention for a very long time, and I have lost family and friends to suicide. And my personal belief is that not every single suicide death is going to be prevented. But what I hope for is that every person has the opportunity to talk calmly and planfully and weigh the pros and cons about what does it mean to you and what does it mean to those people who you care about. You know, we know there are states that have legalized even physician-assisted suicide. And we know that that's been going on way before it was legal and in states that it's not legal. So what I hope is that there can always, regardless of whether it's related to age, mental health, physical health, whatever, I always hope that people have plenty of time to make whatever decision they need to make and to know that they've explored really thoroughly, again, the impact on them and other people, and then made a decision. The study of suicide prevention was started by a man named Edwin Schneidman, and one of the things that he said, and it wasn't a flip thing at all, was that no one should ever make the decision about suicide when one is feeling suicidal. And so what I'm saying is that it's not about age, it's not about physical health, it's about do people make choices? They absolutely do make choices, but can we at least try to help them look thoroughly at those choices? And then, you know, what we know is that people are ultimately responsible and do what they do, but we don't want them to do it and not have a chance.
Is it a question about whether you judge the act as wrong or illegal or immoral, or in many religions it is that way? I wonder how you have been looking at it in your organizations. I know that family members and friends can be angry that somebody left them like that.
Well, religion has changed quite a bit. It used to be in the Catholic religion and in Judaism, if you took your life, if you believed in an afterlife, that you would not go to heaven. And that has changed in both religions now because people realize that mental illness is like any other illness. It's like diabetes or cancer or heart problems. And so I think that the clergy, all clergy now, look at it in a different way than it used to be looked at.
And how in your organizations, Marcia, do you each consider that? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that you stay away from a judging of.
I don't have the ability to tell anybody with any kind of concern, that I know exactly what they need to do, what's right for them with their values and their feelings. But I can create a safe space, and our staff can create a safe space for people to talk about that. You know, whether it's somebody bereaved by suicide, whether it's somebody who's using substances, there are all kinds of things. So that's what I'm saying is we need to give people the opportunity so they don't get forced into choices. And we need to have people who can give the help that's needed as well.
Well, we're going to go take a short break. And when we return, we're going to talk about the grieving process and what happens to people left behind. And also all those digital artifacts that are left behind when people pass away and how some are trying to organize it before they go. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about suicide and what can be done to prevent it. Our guests are Marcia Epstein of the Headquarters Counseling Center, Bonnie Swade of Suicide Awareness Survivor Support. Marcia, you want to talk a minute about what can be done when you think that this might be a problem, how you can help someone.
And just in the most simple ways, what I would say is that if you're around somebody and you notice they seem to be feeling distressed in some way because of the way they look, they talk, they act, then reach out. Then say, you know, hey, it looks like you're not feeling so well. And if they say something that gives you any reason to believe that they're thinking about suicide, ask the question. Say, you know, from what you've said, I'm wondering if you're thinking about suicide. And let them answer that question. And for most people, the next step is going to be, let's figure out how to get you some help. And so we say at our center and with our Kansas Youth Suicide Prevention Program, ask the question and make the call. If you don't know where else to call, call 800-273-8255, whether you're bereaved by suicide, whether you yourself are suicidal, or whether you're concerned about somebody who is. And we will help you with our immediate counseling and also let you know about supports that are available to you.
That was the hotline number. Can you give that number again?
Sure. 800-273-8255. And that works from anywhere in our country.
But a lot of people wouldn't want to ask that question because they'd think, I don't want to put the idea in the person's head.
Right. And what we know is that we've all been exposed to the idea of suicide. We did a lot of suicide prevention education with 8th graders, so 13-year-olds. And there would be very few of them at that age who hadn't had some contact with somebody who had attempted or died by suicide or read or watched something about it. We know about it. We don't plant the seed. We create the opportunity for help when we ask the question.
And we're going to move into talking a little bit about the grieving process. And you mentioned that you can call that number if you are bereaved. And we're bringing into the conversation Natalie Pennington, a graduate student at the University of Kansas, who's researching online expressions of grief when people die. Hi, Natalie. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
We're talking about the afterlife of suicide and what happens online. Thinking about this, a prominent case recently here in Kansas City of Martin Manley, who left this elaborate website when he took his life. Can one's online self continue after death? And how do you interact with your loved one's online profile after death? Call in to join the conversation. The number is 816-235-2888 or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Natalie Pennington, KU grad student, how did you start researching the online aspects of death and grieving?
Well, I had my own experiences with this. So friends who I had known that had passed away, a person that I had known in my undergraduate had committed suicide. And I went to his profile page and saw a conversation ongoing on that page about how he had done it. And it really surprised me that that kind of conversation would occur online, and let alone on a page that was his page. You know, you can't take that conversation down because the profile is run by somebody who's no longer alive. And there was a lot of people who were really unhappy that that conversation was occurring. And so I started thinking, well, is this helpful? Does anybody really want to hear this? Which just sort of led me down the path of how helpful can it be to have the profile still exist of somebody once they've passed away.
And how are you collecting this research?
Well, I've conducted interviews with students at the University of Kansas. I've done about 45 interviews at this point. And talked to them and actually also looked at profiles of members of the deceased, so friends of theirs, and did content analysis of those profiles and sort of looked at the types of messages that people leave behind.
Do you have any conclusions at this point? I mean, is it helpful or is it harmful?
Mixed reviews. So a lot of people find it helpful in varying ways. So one thing that I thought was really interesting is if you're not comfortable writing on the page, so you're not really, you don't really want to express and say, you know, I miss you, you could send a private message. So, you know, the probability of anybody actually reading that message is obviously low. But for you, it's like calling that phone that, you know, still exists immediately after they've passed away. You still hear their voice on the voicemail. So you still feel a connection by sending that message and writing that note as if it's to them.
And in some ways, I can imagine that would be painful and for some people comforting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's definitely people I talk to as well. So people who were really close to the deceased. There's a few individuals I talked to who it had only been a few weeks since their loved one had passed away. And they indicated that the presence was hard. So seeing people post on the wall, they said, you know, those people aren't close to them. They don't know them that well. They have no right to say anything. And so it's really difficult to navigate, I think, social media online and instances of grief when there's no norms established for who is and is not supposed to post, or if there's even a right to say who is supposed to, and finding out how to get support for people.
Well, Bonnie Swade is here with us of the Suicide Awareness Survivor Support, and you work with grieving family members of people who have taken their lives to suicide. What do people need at that point, and how do people grieve?
Well, everybody grieves differently. One of the things I would like to point out, since we're talking about social media, that several of people that have come to our support group had lost adult children that had been out of state for many years, and so they really only got to see them maybe three or four times a year. And when their son or daughter passed away, they invited people to post online about their relationship with their son or daughter because they felt it was helpful. It gave them a perspective of what that child was like as an adult. They found out things that they had no idea about, positive things. And so that was comforting for them.
And has that been overall, Bonnie, what you found?
That's been some cases. I can't say it's been the norm, but it's been some cases.
Marcia.
And I think what Bonnie's speaking to in part is also that as people bereaved by suicide, we want to remember our loved ones' lives, not just how they died. We don't want to define them as just a person who died by suicide. And so I, like Bonnie, know many examples of people who keep pages up intentionally and cherish those kinds of memories. Now, I also understand what Natalie was saying about the danger of other kinds of posts, and so that is a different kind of a concern. And I would say with youth, we've seen some examples where there has been such accusatory information posted so publicly aimed at, let's say, a girlfriend or boyfriend of the child who died, that there are times when that social media can become really cyberbullying more than any kind of help to anybody.
Natalie, what are the logistics of how this happens? I mean, what happens after you pass, whether by suicide or otherwise? What happens to your Twitter, your Facebook, your websites and everything?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really depends on the policies for the company and how proactive the family and friends are. So Facebook has a policy that a lot of people aren't really aware of, which is that they will memorialize the profile of the deceased or take it down if the family sends in proof of death. So, for instance, if the parents were to send in an obituary that says, you know, my child died, then they can say, please take the profile down, and Facebook will remove it and it's gone. Or they will memorialize it, which means that the only people who have access to that page are people who were already friends with that person, which just allows so that, for instance, if it was a public death and people heard about it, that other individuals can't go in and look at information and try to find out about that person after the fact.
And are part of these norms just being worked out now as people really just are getting used to Facebook as being a part of their social lives, a significant part of their social lives?
I think absolutely that it's been more and more of an issue, and Facebook had to address that as an increasing number of people and profiles that exist online are people who are deceased. But honestly, the majority of the profiles that I looked at in my research weren't memorialized. They were just profiles that were there. And so anybody could still comment, and all the little personal touches, the status updates, the relationship status were preserved.
Natalie, I assume you read about this case of Martin Manley, who's the sports writer in Kansas City, who had this blog and left a really elaborate record of his life. And that's what he wanted people to remember, not how he died. What were your thoughts about that?
I did read about that, and I went and I actually saw the website the same day, I think, that it went up. It was interesting to me, of course. I think that that shows a general shift by people to want to have something that lasts past their death. So the website, I think, is a good example of that. But honestly, there are applications that you can be a part of through social media, for Facebook example, where you could write notes that get sent after your death. So if people could type up a bunch of notes now to friends and then have those sent out over periods of time after they've died. And I think it just goes to show that we want to try to have a way to have something that exists, right? So I think I read that he had paid Yahoo to have that website up for 5 years. He wanted that to last for a long time for people to see and know things about him online.
Marcia, I see you're a little uncomfortable with bringing that up again.
Well, my concern about that website and the public nature of his death is, again, that issue of people who are very vulnerable already and the impact of that, which even the additional media coverage really was more about the sensational act that this person did and the treasure hunt and blah, blah, blah. But we really want to make sure that when we're talking about suicide that we always give some guidance about there is a place to get help. And please give that a try before you or somebody you know dies by suicide.
Natalie Pennington, is there something specific about the way people's digital lives carry on in cases of suicide?
I've done a little research into suicide. But to be honest, I don't know about in terms of how their individual personality lives on, only that when friends comment on it, that they're particularly upset. So there's much more of a decisive conversation ongoing on those profiles where they're, you know, I wish I could have done more. And I think that really speaks to what Marcia was just saying, which is that it's important to really think about these unique instances and how that affects the family and friends.
Bonnie Swade of the Suicide Awareness Survivor Support, is it helpful for friends and family members to be able to have that conversation online about what they could have done?
I think it's helpful in the fact that they can get it out. They can share it and communicate it. But most people cannot do. Unfortunately, it's the guilt that's so big after somebody takes his or her life. And, you know, we always say, I wish I could have done, I should have, I could have, I might have. But the fact of the matter is that that person is basically responsible for his or her choice. And we can try to do everything that we possibly can to make sure that they're safe and they know that they're loved. But their choice is something that we cannot control.
Go ahead, Marcia.
And so like Bonnie's saying, we know that it's very common to feel guilty. It's very common to long for answers about why. But we know that the suicide death is not somebody else's fault. Nobody else made that happen, and nobody had 100% power to prevent that from happening. But there are a lot of people who find online as a good way to share some of their thoughts and questions with other survivors of suicide loss. And one of the advantages, whether it's online, in person, in a support group, on the phone, whatever, is that you start realizing that a lot of the things that you're thinking and feeling are common to other people who've lost loved ones to suicide. And so it can be helpful to know, I'm not crazy because I couldn't remember to pay my bills because all I could think about was the pain, you know. And then you know also from survivors who are farther along in their healing journey that it's the case that it does get better. And it gets better in part because you use supports, you let people help you. But we want to inspire in survivors of suicide loss also, there's hope.
We're speaking with Marcia Epstein of the Headquarters Counseling Center and Bonnie Swade of Suicide Awareness Survivor Support. Also, Natalie Pennington, a graduate student at the University of Kansas, who is researching online expressions of grief when people die. Can one's online self continue after death? Call 816-235-2888 or email us at casecentralstandard@kcur.org. We have a call here from Mimi from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Mimi.
Hi.
And did you have a comment today?
I did. I'll give you a very short background. I'm a 49-year-old handicapped woman who's herself attempted several times a suicide. And I lost my first child, and my son, my eldest son, was kind of a misfit, a deep, dark, kind of gothic edge type person, but a big, huge teddy bear, and extremely intelligent. He was a Mensa member, and he killed himself 6 years ago next month, put a bullet in his brain, and I had no warning. I had absolutely no understanding of why. I know he knew what he was doing, and I know that he did it on purpose. His roommate was present. He did a lot of things online and left a lot of stuff that I have yet been able myself to read, but there is a website set up.
Mimi, how long ago was this?
6 years ago, next month on the 29th.
And what are some of the ways that you are coping?
Well, the first year I went completely crazy. I was I have a degenerative disc syndrome. I've had like 13 surgeries in the last 10 years, and they had me on a lot of narcotics. And I have post-traumatic stress syndrome from a really bad surgery. So I went on a lot of medication, and they put me on a lot of different antidepressants. And I got in that, I don't know how to explain that otherwise, like a record. The needle gets stuck in a groove just over and over and over. I have to, you know, one big hurt for my children and my family, and then it'll be over. You know, one big hurt instead of hurting them a little bit every day. And so, you know, I attempted twice. On the third time, I called for help. Actually, the suicide hotline told me to call back in 4 hours. So I called 911, and it took me 7 hours. It was a lot of talking to get myself admitted. And as soon as I stopped taking the antidepressants, I haven't had a suicidal thought since then. So I've been able to think straight, and been thinking straight over the last 5 years. He knew what he was doing. Obviously, he had his reasons. He set up a way for people to express how they felt. You know, he was with the same girl for 8 years since he was 14 years old, and she just came and saw me.
Well, Mimi, thank you. I'm really sorry for your loss, and I want to talk to our experts here about the way you've handled it and what it means for other people who are going through what you've been through. If you don't mind, I'm going to ask our guests here their thoughts about the situation that you described, but we are really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
There are suicide support groups out there that I know that are very helpful for some, not for everyone, but you do realize that you're not alone, which is very important, and you realize that some of the common thoughts that you have, other people are also feeling the same thing. So rather than go through being sad and grieving on your own, a lot of people find support in talking to a therapist, going to a church group, going to a support group. But it is important that you not try to handle it by yourself, because it just gets bigger and bigger. So I don't know if Mimi went to a support group, but I would encourage that to happen if that has not been the case.
It's never too late to get help, and we know that that kind of loss is so huge. And Mimi, again, we are so sorry for your loss. And we know that it's healing isn't like this progress that you go through step one, step two, step three, and then you're done in a certain amount of time. You loved your son. He is with you always. He will always be a part of your life. And you will always have times when you feel extremely sad because he chose to die. And you will also have times when you laugh about silly things that he did. And you'll have times when you remember being kind of annoyed with him because of things that he did. Because that's how it is. I mean, Bonnie and I are both parents, and we know that is part of the pain, is we're not supposed to outlive our kids. That's not supposed to happen. And it is the case that again, there are ups and downs in the grieving. There just are. But the more that you can let other people who also have walked a similar path be with you, and you'll find that things you share are helpful to somebody else as well as things they share are helpful to you. It's a win for everybody, and it's never too late to start those kinds of conversations. So I hope that you will, and I hope that other people listening to this will. And literally in our group, we had a woman who came who was in her 70s, whose dad had died when she was 12. I mean, it wasn't too late, and it helped her with later years.
Are people who have had family members who have taken their lives more prone to that, Marcia?
Nobody has to die by suicide because there's been a death in their family. And the more you talk to people, the more people you realize have had deaths in their family or people close to them. So that's the starting point. It doesn't have to happen again. Does it make you vulnerable? Is it considered a risk factor, one of those things that you can't change? Yeah, it's a risk factor, but it's not a predictor.
Natalie Pennington, the grad student at KU, and I think it's really difficult because suicide is a very particular instance of a conversation that would happen after someone would die. I mean, it's very different from people dying by other causes. I wonder, Natalie, is it sometimes more controversial whether to leave somebody's site up because it was a suicide?
I think it can be, but I think if you go back to the messages and sort of, a little bit about what Mimi was talking about and also what Marcia said, it's that what it comes down to is that the need to have a social network to talk to and people to, who've gone through that. So everybody else who's friends with that person that committed suicide is connected to them through that profile. And so they are, theoretically experiencing what you're experiencing. And so who better to talk to through that page than those individuals? And so it may be a more difficult conversation, but it's the best opportunity to connect with other people who are experiencing that. And as long as that page exists, then you can continue to have that conversation.
And do you find a difference between teens and adults and how they handle this online?
So far, I've only studied college students and their experiences with death.
which is right in between, in a way, of teens and adults. We have a couple of comments on Facebook. Diana writes, "My mother died suddenly when it was still relatively rare for parents to use the site. I didn't even know she had a page until Facebook suggested we be friends several years later. It was a heartbreaking moment, but I can see how many people use their friends' pages as part of the modern grieving process." And I think that maybe that's partly why Facebook has now made that change to be able to turn somebody's page into a memorial page. Kathleen writes, "Facebook is the new wailing wall, and as such, I take great comfort in visiting Facebook pages of loved ones who have died." Is that part similar to what you're hearing, Natalie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think more often than not, it's the overtime. So, you know, every time you have a big thing that happens in your life, it's that chance to go and say, you know, "I just graduated from college and I wish you could have been there with me to do it." Holidays, people go and they write on the page and remember. So, you know, even if it's been 6 years since somebody's passed away, you still go back to that page and you're seeing active posts that happened, you know, the day before.
What do you think about the danger of, you know, Facebook and websites and all of that glamorizing the act? I mean, by remembering somebody in this way.
Well, I think that with the instance that we're talking about in Kansas City with the sportscaster who created his website, that that's certainly a unique case, and that it's important to not focus on, you know, "I chose to take my life and commit suicide," but rather the other parts of that page that are attempts to prolong sort of his presence online for friends and family. And so I don't think that having a page glamorizes death by any means. It simply offers a means of social support for people after the fact.
And I would also add that Facebook actually has some additional policies related to suicide. So if, for example, I go to the page of a loved one who died by suicide and there's some comment that's really disturbing, I can message Facebook, in essence, and they can choose to remove a comment. And also, if somebody posts something that implies that they are also planning suicide because of this pain, if people, you know, often on a page, you don't know who those other people are, you can report that through this Facebook policy. And that actually will result in that person being contacted by somebody from the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline.
Well, we're just wrapping up right now, and I want to thank you all, but I want to ask before we go, just quickly, is there one thing that has helped people cope? And maybe we'll start with you, Natalie Pennington, but one sense you got from your research, one aspect of online conversations that help people cope.
Yeah, if there's one thing that I would say to take away from my research, it's that do what works best for you. So if that's sending the private message, if that's just going to look at the page and see what other people write or writing yourself, stay within your comfort zone and just find what kind of support you need in times of grief. Don't try to do something that doesn't work for you.
Well, thank you. Natalie Pennington is a PhD candidate at KU's Department of Communication Studies. Bonnie Swade, any parting words about that?
I would say that know that you're not alone. There are so many people out there that want to help, and don't be afraid to ask for help.
Bonnie is of the Suicide Awareness Survivor Support, and you can find information about that online and all these organizations. Marcia Epstein of the Headquarters Counseling Center.
My parting comments would be talk. You know, talk to somebody who needs to talk. Talk to somebody when you need to talk, and find the right person. And overall, the more we can just be kind to each other, the more we can make differences in big ways that we may never know.
And thank you all for joining us. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard pages of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore Latin music's influence in America and Kansas City jazz. Up to Date is next with the life events that shaped Charles Manson, plus why children's literature remains so white. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.